We'll begin with the first question and the discourse on setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. Towards the end it says, my knowledge and vision of reality regarding the Four Noble Truths in their three phases and 12 aspects. What are the three phases and 12 aspects? Thanks for your teachings. Okay, this is a bit of esoteric knowledge for you all. It's actually there's a refrain in the discourse where there is this noble truth of dukkha or suffering. This noble truth has to be understood, and then this noble truth of suffering has been understood. So that's its three phases, and of course with each noble truth, then that makes 12, so that the first noble truth, of dukkha, has to be understood. The second noble truth, the cause of suffering, is to be abandoned, and of course then it is abandoned. And then the third noble truth, there is this third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. This cessation of suffering has to be realized, and then has been realized, and then the path leading to cessation of dukkha is the fourth truth. That path has to be developed, and then so that makes it into the three phases and the 12 aspects. Okay, great. In the chant on the Buddha's words in loving kindness, it's great. People are paying attention to the chants. What does the line that says unburdened with duties mean? Does it mean that we are to not have duties, or that we do not feel burdened by them, or does it mean something else? Thank you. So, I don't know. I can't remember the... Anybody remember the Pali?
I'd have to go through it. Pali.
Right, that's usually I have to sort of start from the beginning, recite it in my mind, and I can get to the lines. Oh, right, that's what that is. It does mean unburdened with duties would mean stepping back from unnecessary duties. I mean, not sort of looking for more duties to sort of hang around your neck. But then there's the recognition that there are duties and responsibilities that we all have, and to not create a burden out of them. So that learning how to carry the different duties, responsibilities that we have in a skillful way. Now I think of somebody like Ajahn Chah, who had he took on a lot, and he never ever seen him, feeling overwhelmed or burdened by anything. And one of the illustrations that he gave of that is that asking one of the monks, talking about this, and I'd say, You know, where you see those big rocks over there in front of the ordination hall at Ajahn Chah's monastery. There are these very large, huge actually, rocks, pillars of rock. And he said, you know, are those rocks heavy? And the person, wow, yeah, those are heavy, those are big. And he said, they're not heavy if you don't pick them up. and that's similar with that you know duties that we
I wonder. I think it's just one word. It's superbo.
Apikicho. Contented in
this. So right after
it's apakicho.
Apakicho.
I don't know. I have to refer to the Pali experts on this. Apakicho is the kicha is a duty, so that I mean apa. I'm not quite sure what it means because it doesn't mean with.
So. It means without something.
It means unburdened with duties.
The answer to that question is yes.
Yes. Okay. This has happened a few times only, but I'm puzzled. Please help. Once last week, when my mind was very calm at home, suddenly a sort of energetic feeling is all over the body, and my spine felt very cold, and then suddenly I have a flash of memory from childhood of drowning in the tank in our backyard. On a different occasion, I saw the dead, putrefied face of an old woman, horrific, mouth wide open. Question, how do I deal with all this? I get a shock and concentration stop, sometimes sending shivers. One is sort of making, a difference between what is a memory and then what is a nimitta or a kind of a mental image that arises from from within the mind, so that if something that is a memory, then one is one can be bringing that up and. Especially if it's something that there was some trauma or some feeling of some kind of pain or fear around that, then one can be holding that with a very consciously holding that with compassion, with loving kindness, with sending and dedicating kindness and blessings to that memory of that, that of oneself as a child. If it's a memory, that's a one way of working with it. If it's a an image that comes up of that is a mental image that is kind of shocking, like this one of the image of a dead person. It's kind of horrifying. Then that has to be investigated in a different way. It can be held in a similar way with, dedications of merit and loving kindness, but then it also can be brought in as a reminder for, death is a certainty. And that can be a heavenly messenger that one's using, turning something that is kind of shocking into a heavenly messenger that is able to create a sense of urgency. And you have to work with it and sort of see, well, does that actually work, or is one just overwhelmed by it? Because if it's, but there's different ways that you want to be working with an actual memory of an event and something that is coming up from within the mind as a mental imagery, because they could be telling you two different things, that to be able to reflect on that. Inevitably, the cultivation of loving kindness is always going to be useful in those circumstances where there's kind of a certain fear that is stimulated. But it's also, there needs to be some reflection on what is actually, what is it stirring up? Where is it coming from? How to understand that, and finding ways that one can be not overwhelmed by fear. So that's where the body awareness, I found one of the really helpful ways of being able to kind of mitigate the tendency to fear, because fear thrives it's kind of a lack of clear objects sometimes, so that when there's coming back to a tangible object, the body, then there's a growing, one can grow and develop a momentum of a clarity of awareness, which helps the mind to reflect and investigate the circumstances within the mind. Okay. John, you spoke about training the heart, quote-unquote, training the heart, over the last couple of days. Could you tell more what heart actually means from the point of practice? Thank you. Well, actually, all I'm doing is trying to alternate the use of heart and mind in place of the same word in Pali. The Pali word is citta, and it encompasses both the when we think of mind, we tend to think of the intellectual, rational, analytical aspects of our being. When we think of heart, we tend to think of more emotional side. And in Pali, there isn't a distinction. There isn't a, the citta encompasses all of that. So that the reason why I go back and forth between the two is because I'm just trying to fill out the picture of what we're working with. Okay, I didn't totally understand the difference between the mind and the mental qualities in regards to the four foundations. Would you elaborate? Yeah, it's. It could be a semantic difference, but it's in the foundations of mindfulness. Then it is the body, feeling is vedana, jitta, which I just talked about, of that both the mood and the thinking aspects of the mind. So it's more like, but in that terms of mind, it's more like the content of the mind in terms of a bit broader. The mind with greed, the mind without greed, the mind with aversion, mind without aversion, the mind that's scattered, the mind that's concentrated, the mind that's spacious, the mind that's contracted. So it's more like a bit more loose, in terms of its kind of maybe like a mood of a mind, a content of the mind. But then the fourth foundation of mindfulness is the mindfulness of Dhamma and Dhammas. And in that sense, it's looking to phenomena or mental qualities within the mind. So then the Buddha points to, five hindrances so these are specific mental qualities that perform a role to hinder and obstruct our practice. There's the mental qualities facilitate and support the practice, the seven factors of awakening. There's things that are kind of neutral, but they're important to understand their place of how they function. So the five aggregates or the six sense bases, they're categories of experience in our practice that we need to be attentive to be able to step back from the habit of identification. And then, of course, the Four Noble Truths as a category of phenomena or mental qualities, Dhamma. So there's a slightly different... they're obviously part of the mind, but they're held or viewed or worked with in a different way. Or they perform a slightly different function. You mentioned that a super practice can cool sensual desire, but what if what you are attracted to is not so much a physical thing, but an attraction of the heart, of good qualities you see? What cools the heart if you are hooked? I don't know. This one want to be. there needs to be a. The reality, of course, is it's not. There's externally directed desire, but it's also in terms of our own perception of ourselves, and that's really important in terms of that asubha practice, that contemplation of the unattractive nature of the body, because that's oftentimes we who was it? The heck was it? We were talking the other day, and I was talking to somebody who was... anyway, they were coming to... Maybe it was coming to the hall or coming somewhere, and then... and their image was reflected back in the glass of the door, and it was sort of, who's that old person with the white hair? And then you get close. It's me. So it's it's easy to forget that we live in the realm of memory and fantasy, kind of using that to establish a sense of okay, a reality check. Also, whatever good qualities one sees, and that's whether it's a even if one is attracted to somebody as a person, or their, it's a loved one, or it's oneself, or a teacher, everybody is subject to aging, is subject to sickness, to subject to death. So that contemplation of the unattractive nature of that physical existence is a really important quality for grounding oneself in, okay, this is the true nature of things. And it lightens the heart, really, in that sense of cooling of desire, a cooling of expectation, a cooling of how we would like the world to be in an idealized version of it. And so, this is the way things are. How often and for how long do you recommend practicing meditation at home? Daily, twice a day, 45 minutes, 30 minutes, etc.? Thank you. You can't really mandate it, but the more the better. There's always lots of excuses for cutting it back, it's helpful to... it's also helpful to not idealize what you think you should be doing and then feel miserable doing it, trying to keep up to that. So there's a real balance that you have to pay attention to. A daily practice, morning and evening, for periods of time that are manageable, it's really important to have that consistency. Even if, because sometimes, you meditate and it's the pits. but just doing it is really important, so that it's one's placing importance on the giving of the time for that sitting down, slowing down, stopping, pulling back from the habits of of our daily routine, and to be able to do that for, each person has to figure that out for themselves. But it's better to start with a routine that is shorter rather than longer, in the sense that something that's manageable and you know is manageable, so that you gain confidence in it and you see the benefit that comes from it. So then it will naturally start to grow, because it's a precious time to give to oneself. You have no problem giving a certain amount of time to showering, brushing your teeth. I mean, you don't begrudge that time. But that kind of, kind of daily hygiene of looking after the mind is really just important for one's own. In the same way, if you stop bathing and stop brushing your teeth and go out in public, then people start to notice. But if you don't look after your mind and keep a good sort of basis of calm and composure, yeah, it affects people too. How do you know sloth and torpor are present, or if you're just plain tired? When is it better to rest the mind or the body than to meditate? Well, sometimes when you when you sit down to meditate and you try to brighten the mind, you try to energize the mind, try to energize the body, and really nothing's working, to be able to just go ahead and have a rest is probably more fruitful endeavor. It is important to sort of pay attention to sloth and torpor. It can gain traction in the mind, so that if one does walking meditation and one still kind of falling asleep, then you may as well just go and rest. But if you've tried this, tried that in while you're sitting, and sometimes it's quite intractable. But then if you get up and move, then the mind clears. You're starting to get a handle. Okay, it was probably just sloth and torpor. It's a bit, the mind isn't really wanting to engage. But once you have that physical movement, then it dissipates. So that's sometimes a good way to recognize. And also, in terms of particular patterns, I think we all have particular patterns where sloth and torpor kind of kicks in at certain times of day for different people at different times, so that. Or that's what I've noticed, certainly for myself. I'm not physically tired, but I shouldn't be. Evening time for me is meditating for 40 years or whatever, I have to be careful with sloth and torpor for around that time, so that it's also one of the reasons why I set up. Well, I've got the opportunity to set up. I'm running this retreat, and I can set it up like you want to. then do questions and answers rather than having to give a talk when it's my dullest point of the day. I think everybody has probably different times. Once I get past a period, once I get past 8 o'clock, then I'm awake again. And I have to be careful around that time. So it's just knowing your own cycles and you're knowing your own energies. Okay. For all the monastics individually, I don't know if they're going to want to go down the line. When was the last time something made you really angry? And if you don't mind sharing, what was it? Just trying to feel the humanness within the rooms. Thanks. I don't know. It's a long time. Anything really get up your nose lately?
I'll pass to John.
That in itself is...
Only slight irritations, not like out-and-out anger.
Rage has been supplanted by just irritation.
I mean, not even that much, but just...
Yeah, I mean, that's the fruits of the practice, really, that sense of where it's hard to actually remember. When was that last time I got really, really angry at something or somebody?
Kasapo is really angry.
Yeah, Kasapo, he does it all the time. he's so even, it's always been that way. Okay, dear Rinpo, thank you for so many wonderful teachings. I'm contemplating cessation and would like to hear more about the cessation of the body, death. I have been with a few beings as they have died, one human and a few pets. Is the manner of death important to having a quote-unquote good rebirth? Does being afraid or suffering a great deal affect the next life directly, or is the experience of death just added to one's overall karma? The manner of death, in terms of, it has a direct conditioning in the sense of if it's a violent death or a really sudden death, then it's dependent on how, somebody is unprepared or not very present, that can have a negative effect on rebirth. Before anything, you have to sort of say, it's all uncertain, in the sense that because even at death, the nature of the mind is also able to catch up with itself, so that it's able to reflect on itself. So that even at the point of death, it's seen as a as a real opening or possibility, it's well known in the in the Tibetan tradition, the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Bardos and whatnot, but within the Pali teachings, both the discourses and the commentaries, that point of death is seen as a very important point of establishing mindfulness and possibilities of, say, like entering the stream. Really, it's a really ripe possibility because it's a ripe possibility for relinquishing, seeing clearly. So that's a everything that is going to say, like in terms of if there's a violent death or a, and that's why it's helpful at in terms of looking after somebody who's dying, to really try to make them as comfortable as possible, so that there is an ease of passing, a feeling of trust, a feeling of security with the people that are around them, so that one isn't sort of exacerbating the natural tendency to be fearful, because it is uncertain, so that one wants to try to help and support people, and also for oneself, as one approaches death, and paying attention to the ways that one can practically kind of approach one's death with, a lot of patience and a lot of humility, because one might have read a lot of Buddhist books and this sort of the hagiographies of these great masters and conceive of how you're going to die, and because you know that that's the best way to do it, and come in to one's death with a whole list of objectives that you're going to fulfill at that time. You just make yourself miserable. So that sense of patience and humility. Of course, you shouldn't wait till you die to bring those in. Okay, Ajahn, is it possible to post a list of the focuses of the 16 steps? It would be a helpful resource for the remainder of the retreat. Can we do that? Sure, we can. We'll print it up. Yeah, it's... thank you so much for these beautifully framed teachings, spot on, direct to the point, as always. Thank you. It's been years since I needed to do so much laying down meditation. My back is not cooperating this retreat. Can you refresh my memory on tricks to not fall asleep? Eyes open feels as if I struggle to maintain it. There's a variety of things that one is especially if one. It depends on what one has to do for one's back in order to be comfortable. Sometimes, like I always found, if one can lay on one side or the other, that's helpful. It may not be, if it's not good for the back, then that's not what you're doing, but or not what should be done. But that's one way of. That if I'm, because there's a natural tendency of if one's laying flat on one's back to sort of melt into the floor, so that laying on one's side in a posture that is comfortable enough, one can use some, especially if one's having trouble with one's back, you know, using some pillows for propping up, but not getting too totally propped up, because it is that there has to be a balance of comfort and then practicality as to what is a support for one's body. Using things like how one places one's hands, you know, it's like just that kind of energy of holding a posture and then bringing attention to that point. If one's even laying on one's back, just holding the hands up just above the stomach a little bit like that. So there's a little bit of effort that's required to hold that posture. And then it's oftentimes enough to gather energy at that point. And then keeping the eyes open. Also sometimes with lying, if one's familiar enough with some of the chanting. Chanting is a great way of creating a real pleasant energy, and one can do that in whatever posture. And then also just say the recitation of a mantra, of Buddho, really using the Buddho as a means of focusing the mind and keeping an alertness of a mind, alertness of attention, so that Buddho, in-breath, Buddho, out-breath, Buddho, which might be too slow and too relaxing. So you just using the mantra itself. Buddho, 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 just you not paying attention to the breath at all. It's using the mantra. So that, you know, just experimenting with things like that usually quite helpful. Just little things that help to gather energy a little bit. regarding the anusatis, which are the recollections, how does one recollect or contemplate the devas? These are practices. Anusati means to recollect, to bring to mind, to recall, so that the recollections that are directly recommended by the Buddha, it comes up in the discourses, a recollection of the Buddha, recollection of the Dhamma, recollection of the Sangha, recollection of generosity, of giving, recollection of virtue, of sila, and then recollection of the devas. And then there's a fuller there's a selection in the Visuddhimagga of the 10 recollections, and that increases to recollection of death, recollection of the body, recollection of peace is the last one, and all. Always come up one short in these lists. There's one more somewhere.
Generosity.
No, I think it might.
Virtue, generosity, and
yeah, those are in the first one. That's in the first six. Maybe it is Anapanasati. Recollection of breath. Anyway. look it up. Anyway, we're talking about the recollection of the devas. So devas are the celestial beings, heavenly beings, beings in heavenly realms, and which are, say, in the Buddhist in the Buddhist teachings, in the discourses, they're scattered all throughout. Was a very ordinary part of how the Buddha, what the Buddha described in his experience, because it's hard to do a recollection of the devas if one is a dedicated nihilist, and traditionally, what is because the devas are after death, the being reborn as a deva is a fortunate rebirth in a pleasant realm, the recollection is more around the recollection of karma. In a sense, like that's how it's described, so that so by recollecting that the actions that those devas did in their previous birth to take rebirth in the deva realm, I've done those too. And that's so that it's a recollection of one's own skillful, wholesome actions, and that it bears fruit in the over not just sort of in this lifetime, which is because in the recollections of generosity, recollections of virtue, one seeing the fruits of one's wholesome action in this present life. But then the recollection of the devas is recollecting that those wholesome, skillful actions bear fruit not only in this life, but in future lives. So that it's a it's an encouragement and a source of confidence for oneself as one lives a life in the world. Okay. Regarding the first precept of non-killing, non-harming, what to do on a practical decision level regarding something like termites? I sold my last house because I didn't want to fumigate, but I can't keep moving. To avoid killing termites, ants that eat at a house. Thank you for your compassion and explanation. It's tough keeping these precepts, isn't it? There's, one of the things is that generally you want to be putting as much effort as possible into protection and being able to cut off the avenues of entry point and to a building, to trying to keep them. Especially termites from getting in, and that's good advice when you're building a monastery like we are, and you can do that at the front end, and It's not very helpful when you're actually in the situation, and or that it's advanced to a point. There's a whole bunch of ways that one tries to do it in a using kind of things. I don't know. There's things that they don't like. And I don't know what termites don't like. I certainly know what. Using rather than actual pesticides, using them. Oftentimes things like tea tree oil, garlic, those are things that they really don't like, and so that if one can be using that as a spray, keeping them from coming in and going out, and that's a helpful thing. But there sometimes gets to a point where you kind of have to bite the bullet and accept the karma. Either that or move. Again. and that's, we ended up, say, Abhayagiri, we ended up facing that same problem. It's a public place, it was during the time when we were doing all the preparations for a change of use permit to get the permission to build the monastery, and there was county inspectors showing up there all the time, and we had a dodgy relationship with them, actually, with some of them. Some of them were quite nice, some of them not so. And we started getting an infestation of cockroaches. And we did everything. And they just kept multiplying like crazy. And it was just...
Over a year and a half or so.
It was like a year and a half. It was awful. And they just got totally shameless after a while. They wouldn't even... wouldn't even run away when you come into the room. They were in everything. I mean, they're inside the microwave. It was just awful. The hot water pump. It was just it was it. Exactly. if we don't do something about this, I mean, it's just not safe. And also, if a county inspector shows up and sees this, we're never going to get permission to have a monastery. We called the... we did a lot of chanting and sending loving kindness, and, this is your time to go. There was a lot of them there when the exterminators finally came. Even the exterminator was impressed at how many there were. It was bad.
I think that the salient point that you mentioned was that we didn't do it pretending that there wasn't going to be some possible karmic effect. It was we know that, something. And we're willing to.
Yeah, this isn't wholesome karma. this is not wholesome karma. You don't want to fool yourself that you're making merit. Okay. The problem of extremes. Yesterday, Bhitti. this morning, the horrors of the bait and craving for annihilation in all their ugliness. Then, piti again. The only thing I've figured is to back off from meditation when things get too extreme. Any other suggestions? It's helpful to pull back and just relax, get another perspective. And there's a little thing in the bottom. I'm not getting coolness, that sense of recognizing, these are extremes. The mind is swinging. And it's also, it's the third day today. That's pretty standard. Sort of putting it in another perspective. Third day meditation retreat. Things are swinging. They haven't really settled. Hasn't really got a good footing yet. Not to take it too seriously. Not to buy into one extreme over the other. Have some kindness for yourself. Don't push, and just be willing to investigate. There's an extreme of mind being, the horrors of the bait. We can still investigate that. Piti arises. They're objects of investigation as opposed to experiences that define us. And that's really important to pay attention to, because we tend to define ourselves by our experiences. And, we get piti and rapture and, everything's going great. And there's this, the horrors of the bait, and it's, oh my God, everything's falling apart. The practice is really is to recognize that we don't need to be, we don't need to identify ourselves with those experiences. Those are just experiences, and that in the mindfulness of breathing, that last tetrad, contemplating impermanence. Breathe in, contemplating impermanence, I breathe out. That takes it to a different perspective. Or contemplating uncertainty, contemplating unsure. Breathe in. It's just using that quality of anicca to see its changing, shifting quality, as opposed to it honing in and locking in onto one extreme or the other. That ability to reflect and investigate is really it's our refuge, really, because the experiences are going to change, the experiences are going to shift, and they don't really define you as a practitioner.